Okay. So, is that better? So, the purpose of this one is about identifying lameness in the global net. We've got the 2 points of test in Australia and Japan. We do a 15-day test saying, you're lame, and then we start telling people they get 45 days to clean up their act. And if nothing is done in that time, people get disconnected. This dates back to 4-5 meetings ago, so that's 2.5 years we've been implementing this policy. We first actually did action at the end of 2004. We had a bit of delay to try and get the process right. We actually started tracking in our ticketing system around the same date. We got resolution within a week, and we took the action of actually undelegating people early in 2005. Okay, so the current status. Sorry about the clipping on the titling. It's a slightly messy graph. The big jagged line at the end is a data loss we had in data collection. Wow. But it actually also coincides with the measures which are new since the last time I showed this graph. So in the absence of a laser pointer and not wanting to move from here because I must speak into the microphone, the observation I'd make is that the difference between the two states is effectively constant. And if you look at the bottom line, which is the remaining lame domains, it's also effectively constant. I'm arguing here that we have probably, thank you very much, my able chair assistant, we have probably reached a maximum in terms of our effectiveness in this policy. This seems to be kind of where we're going to stay. Another point of view of this is looking at the correction rate. So the red line is the underlying uncorrected error rate. If we did nothing, how bad would it be? And then we have what we're doing to correct, and then we're showing the amount of stuff we've undelegated. And you can see they're all pretty much flat lines. I mean, yeah, there's some variation, but allowing for noise, this is how the world is. So we're cowling this somewhere around a reduction from 18% down to 8%, 8 to 10, and it seems to be constant. You've got to take into account there's process effects here, that it takes 60 days to do a resolution on any one instance. We still haven't gone to IPv6 yet. That's just going to take some time before that's operationally viable. Now, that, oh, right, I see. Yes, don't set something to transparent. That's not a good idea. I had a pie chart here of lameness by economy, which I seem to have completely wiped out. Okay, that's a bit of a pain. We'll skip on. So going back to this chart with a flatline state, if we take the point that it's effectively achieved its maximum effect, if we're going to make any more difference to this problem, we actually have to think about undertaking some additional activity. We're going to have to look at other ways to tackle the problem. And the suggestion that's being floated internally within the Secretariat is that we start hosting secondary DNS services. So this would mean that we would offer the membership the ability to use us as a reliable source of DNS for their reverse delegations that we would host on servers we operate. Now, we have the potential to think about doing this in 4 locations. I would not commit that we will be doing this at all 4 locations, but this is the current list of places we could potentially provide service. We would have to think about some investment in technology to improve on our infrastructure. We'd have to think about a process that we were going to use to do this. Obviously, we'd look at using MyAPNIC. We'd think about using a DNS management framework. And if it's going to happen, then the developments that we're undertaking at the moment to improve DNS are going to be critical. And there should actually be a presentation later on today that talks about some things we're thinking of doing. But the idea would be that membership would be able to use us as a secondary. This would be quite distinct from our service of delegating down from the tree normally. This would be run separately. And on the basis that we are not going to be lame because we're well connected at exchange points, we may be able to make further reductions in that figure that we're seeing. The pie chart that unfortunately I've wiped out of my slide pack showed that the distribution of lameness is 30% in Australia, which may very well be just the historical overhang of the AUNIC process, and then runs through the major economies. I'd actually expected that it was going to predominantly be in internet economies that might have major connectivity issues. the places that are likely to be on congested links, likely to have problems. That actually doesn't seem to be the case. This is a generally problem. This problem is generally dispersed throughout our community and basically tracks the volume of IP address active in an economy more than any particular aspect of that economy. But nonetheless, this seems like a sensible offering to do. So that's where we are. Are there any questions? Ed, hello.
About your previous slide, next steps. There were this thing on.
It's just very quiet. Be very quiet.
Okay. Two things on the your next steps. Offering to host secondaries for people would only work for the people whose servers don't answer you. I would guess. Because generally, if people are making a mistake in generating their zone and they're lame because of that, slaving for them is not going to solve that lameness problem.
Can you say that again? Because I'm not sure I'm following what you're sure. saying here.
Right. Some people are lame because they have incorrectly made their zone files or configured their servers.
Yes. So they are asserting an IP level service right. on port 53. It's just broken.
Right. And if that's the case there, if you are slaving from them, you may not be getting the master their zone file transfer.
Right.
So I would say that that would be most effective if you're getting no answer from them today.
Right. Our measure of lameness views people who present us with files that we think have problems as partial. It's a disagreement we have about what is and is not lame, but we had to take a minimalist position and weren't able to say, oh, look, you've got disagreement in your zone serial between two places or things like that. We couldn't actually say that's lame.
Right.
So when I say lame on here, I mean people that really their server is totally hosed. It's not. There's nothing there.
Right. So they're not answering at all.
Yeah. And in that case, if they actually come to us, register with us, say here is a master we can fetch from, we get live there the ability to say no. Sorry, we can't do 53 on you. We cannot fetch the zone from you. That's just broken.
Right.
And only at the point they'll feed us a zone do we then say, yup, we're up for serving. Sure, there's the possibility we then can't do refresh off them and our data's going stale, but the likelihood is that we're going to be a persistent view of what they wanted in reverse.
Right. I was just going to say that's what it would take care of. The other comment I had was that there's a reverse discussion in RIPE, the RIPE region, in October.
I've heard of that region.
Yeah. They apparently host slaves for some people.
Yeah.
And I think it was for free. I mean, it's not top of my mind, I guess. Someone there said that they wanted RIPE to consider stopping this free giveaway service so that they could, sell the service in competition.
I don't think we've really got an issue there with our membership.
I'm just saying, this is a discussion at the last RIPE meeting.
Yeah, I can't honestly see that that's going to be an issue in our membership, but obviously we'll put this one out to the community for review. But that's where our current thoughts lie. I have succeeded in restoring the graph. Please accept my apologies. So 30% is coming from Australia, 15% from China, 8% from Taiwan, 6% from Singapore, 6% from India, 5% from New Zealand, those Kiwis, 5% from Hong Kong, and then it kind of tails off. So I was really very surprised by how the balance worked out, but I still believe, nonetheless, this service would improve the situation markedly.
Does that include legacy?
Yes, that includes legacy. If it's in our system through a transfer, we use our current framework to manage it, and that includes checking it. So it's the whole shebang, the whole box and dice. It doesn't include NIRs because we don't have records of note to do a test against. So I would not like to make any inference from this about what the exposed level of lameness in Japan really is, because I'm not actively at this stage doing aggressive testing against them. I say I actually mean we, because this is actually all Terry's work, by the way. So for I, read we. Sorry, Terry. Okay, so moving right along, Sanjaya. on IPv6.int deprecation.
Thanks, George. Is this good enough? Okay. Right. This is a project update on a policy implementation on IPv6.int reverse DNS service deprecation of IPv6 and reverse DNS service in APNIC. I'll go over the just a reminder of why we're doing that and what the proposal is, and then with the project status. The background is the use of IPv6.int domain has been deprecated 5 years ago, well, four and a half years ago by RFC 3152, but there's no real instruction to the RIRs to stop the service, but then there's an RFC 4159, which is August 2005, 4 years later, saying specifically that the regional internet registries, or RIR, are advised that we no longer need to maintain the operation of the IPv6.int reverse DNS service. And the fact that APNIC has also stopped accepting new IPv6.int domains as of June 2004. But then we also noticed that the query rate for that domain is still around 5 queries per minute. Then we think that we should make a proposal to the membership whether we should terminate this service or not. So the proposal like this. It is proposed that APNIC cease devoting resources to support the operation of this deprecated domain and the cutoff date to be determined jointly with the other RIR. And for an orderly cutoff of the service, we think that these steps need to be done. Number one is we notify all parties who are still sending queries or interact with our servers on this domain that we are stopping the service. Also, we would send public announcement, and then there's a coordination work with the root IPv6.int, which is Bill Manning, to actually remove the APNIC delegation from the on the cutoff date. And we are going to report the project status in this meeting. So this is the project status. Right. First off, we are going. We were told to measure what is the nature of the IPv6.int queries. We did two separate measurement dates. One is in November 2005, and another one on February 2006. The one on November 2005 is 2 days measurement, and 2006 is six days measurement. George Michelson did the measurement and analysis. We saw that most of the IPv6 data flow is actually coming from zone checks and zone refresh and zone notify. So if you look at the graph here, these two. This is the zone refresh, and that is the notify. The light green color is an ARPA. This is not working. Okay. And the November 2005, and then this February 2005 on INT, we can see that there's actually a decline already. But compare that to the normal, you know, PTR or NS query, it's the majority of the transaction is actually only on that, which is more of a communication with the secondaries. If we zoom into these very small activities, then we can see that actually this this is an anomaly in November caused by a faulty Linux configuration. So there's just a burst of it. But on February 2006, we can see that they're actually very small. So it's actually just half a query per minute. So one query every 2 minutes. It's very low. At the bottom.
For those of you who are DNS fanatics, this is the emerging world of DNSSEC, and there is an astronomically small amount of emerging queries coming from Europe, almost overwhelmingly, who are beginning in V6 to verify DNSSEC, DNS key related state, which has come from the RIPE NCC. So this is the early visibility of DNSSEC. Thank you.
Thanks, Jors. Interesting. All right. So so from those graphs, we then know that it's very few NS request service in IP6.int already. And the Linux, faulty Linux is actually dominated that, the PTR queries. This is actually what we are seeing, 36 IP6 in queries in November 2005. Remember, this is a 2 days, George?
Yes.
And this one is a 6 days, and you get less in 6 days. So it's actually going down quite significantly from this to that. On to the coordination work. This is the non-technical areas. We've spoken with the other RIRs trying to see if we need to coordinate this as a global activity. If yes, are we going to do it at the same time? So the conclusion is all RIR agreed to stop the service on the same date, and that date is would be the 1st of June this year. And we have agreed to work together in the public communication and the technical activities. Knowing that the Japanese community and the NIR committees, particularly Japanese, have a strong interest in IPv6 development, we consult with them to check for issues or scheduling conflicts, and basically they're satisfied that the 1st of June 2006 is a good date. The remaining thing to do is actually to talk with Bill Manning and advise Bill Manning and make sure that our records will be removed in due time. So this is the schedule. This is today. Well, no. And then that's the cutoff date, 1st of June. Most of the activities are basically a notification. The third-party notification will look at our log again and see if we can contact those who are still sending IP6 in queries to us, and see if we can tell them that we are stopping the service. Public announcement a few times, and then this is where we will tell wrote IP6.int to remove our records there, and then we will just stop it. on the 1st of June. Yeah, that's all. Any questions? There was an interesting analysis presented by Kazu in IPv6 technical SIG earlier today. Was it tomorrow? Was it yesterday? God. Yesterday. So you might want to look at his presentation on the potential impact deprecating this service. It's quite positive. He doesn't see that there will be a major problem, but still there will be some impact.
Okay, so now I'd like to ask Yanea-san to come and present on BGP Anycast node requirements for authoritative name servers.
Good afternoon. This is Yonea from JPRS. I'd like to explain our experiences about the Anycast DNS node deployment in the overseas. So from the our experiences, I'd like to discuss about the something to have a DNS in abroad and how to operate it and other criteria to select a node location or lines. So this is a background for the IP Anycast service in the world. So the IP Anycast service, IP Anycast DNS is widely deployed in the root servers, and nowadays TLD servers also hiring the IP Anycast DNS service. And some of TLD servers are using existing Anycast service such as ISC and Packet Clearinghouse, VirtualDNS, etc. So the most of 50s are using those services. And some of TLDs are using their own Anycast service. And GP is also trying to deploy our own Anycast service. And this is the motivation for the IP Anycast for the DNS. So I think most of you know the benefit of the IP Anycast, so that I will skip this page. And this is the principle to deploy IP Anycast DNS. So the using IP Anycast DNS is a technique, should be a technique to increase reliability of the DNS service. And to realize the reliability, the operation have to be a single contact and the consistent operated by the consistent policy. And without this principle, then the DNS behavior will be differ from the each Anycast node. And to realize DNS Anycast service should use well-known and mature techniques. And to know what is the common and well-known services is to have a common guideline, such as RFC 3258 or Anycast. This is still internet draft, but written by Joabri, and RFC 2182 and RFC 2870. Those are the root server and the secondary server requirements. So this kind of BCP or informational document for the Anycast operation is required. So that this our intention is to have common IP Anycast guideline for TLD DNS servers. And my colleagues wrote an internet draft named Draft Morishita DNS of Anycast Node Requirements. And this document is based on our experiences and still work in progress. And the reason why we select TLDs is the TLD features, TLD the DNS features are very different from the features of root servers. That is, TLD has larger zone size, and TLD has higher zone update frequency, so that the operation of the TLD server and the root server is very different. And this, in this slide, I will explain about the targets and main focuses of our document. The targets targets are BGP Anycast. We are focusing on BGP Anycast, so that they placing Anycast nodes very widely, and all of those nodes are global nodes. Global node means that every Anycast node accept queries from the outside. And main focus is selection of the ISPs and selection of the IP Anycast node location. Node location means the physical place, such as data center. And third point is evaluation of proper cost. Because of the DNS, operating DNS costs higher because of the leased line and the data center, high secure data center, so that we are going to know how we estimate the proper cost. And evaluation of proper measurement and monitoring methods. Without this, then we cannot know the proper cost or proper operation. And about the selection of the ISP, the requirement of us is to have geographical and the network topological diversity. And to realize these requirements, we had several points to evaluate. That's those are reliability of the ISP backbone network and connectivity of ISP to outside area and ISP's peering status and connectivity for DNS service. For the Anycast, the transit service is mandatory because of it uses provider independent address and its own AS number. And connectivity for administration, that means back door for the maintenance and connectivity for IPv6. And this is the point and requirement and points for the selection of IP Anycast node location. Our requirement is to conform to requirements of RFC 2182 and 2817. And our evaluation points are the security level of the data center and the redundancy of electric power supply for the facility and tolerance against disasters. This means, especially in Japan, there are lots of nature disasters, such as earthquakes or typhoon attacks, and diversity of locations. this means there are very few data center, data center providers. There are, for example, in Japan, very few carriers provide the data center, so that the many services are in one or same data center, so that we are considering the diversity of the location itself. And about the evaluation of proper cost, to build a new any cast site, there are two kinds of costs. One is initial or construction cost, and other is running or maintenance cost. And for those costs, including equipment such as routers, switches, servers, and so on, and facilities, that is data center or connectivity, and so on. And lastly, human resources. This is for the daily operation and emergency troubleshooting, and so on. And this human resources is very serious for the remote maintenance. And fourth is evaluation of proper measurement and monitoring method. So we are thinking that ICANN CNNP test is one of useful guideline for the evaluating IP Anycast node. And this means a continuous measurement for the routing stability, reachability, and round trip time. But Anycast site is deployed widely, and selection of Anycast depends on the routing, so that the measurement have to be a multiple point to see the every Anycast site. But it is very hard to make a lot of measurement point in worldwide, so that we are thinking LIPE DNS MOM is one of the possible solution for the measurement. But we have to think about another measurement method. And from now, I will explain about our finding through overseas site. So we constructed overseas site in New York, and from our experiences, we found several things. The one is running cost is dominant for that day. Mostly, the running cost is depends on facilities, including data center and lease line, and also human resources and traveling expense. For the emergency troubleshooting and recovery is very important to getting a budget. So this is unpredictable, so that the emergency, to prepare for the emergency is unpredictable budget. And we found difference of business practices. This is based on different commercial law in each country. So in Japan, data center does not require insurance for the customer. But in the United States, we were requested to have insurance for the data for our equipment. But in the United States, the insurance company does not cannot have contract with a foreign customer, so that it was very hard to have a contract with the insurance company. At last, in United States, we can have contract through the agency, but in France, we also have data center in France, but in France, we cannot have contract with the France insurance company, so that this kind of non-technical barrier is a very difficult to overcome. That is our findings. And others to remind is we met overheat due to lack of placement. So this was, we cannot find when we constructed the data center, But after 1 or 2 months is we built the LAC, then another facilities in front of our LAC spew lots of heated wind, so that the cooler or fan was landing, but it cannot cool the facilities of Earth. And to troubleshoot this kind of things, it was very important to communicate with remote hand, that is data center people. But for us, English is very difficult to communicate with, so that the communication with remote hand is one of the barriers for us, and especially time lag. And for the troubleshooting, we have to ship hardwares to abroad, but it is also the difficult thing because of the long lead time to pass the customs. And this is the future work and discussions. We are going to update our guideline to add other effective portion in it. For example, selection of node locations. So as you know, in some data centers, there are two or more root servers and TLD servers in the same place, in the same data center. Sometimes in the same floor, very near cage. So that from the point of CCTLD or single TLD, this it is a diversity. But from the point of end users, is this diversity or not is a problem. And second one is a selection of server hardware. For the large zone, it requires a very large machine or 64-bit CPU and large memory space. So that we are thinking about having a evaluation point for the server hardware and also server software. And selection of remote maintenance tool or hardware is also very important because of to reduce the travel expense for the remote maintenance. This kind of remote maintenance tool is very important. And also, we have to do effective remote maintenance method. And to reduce the, what to know what is the abnormal, we have to do effective measurement. So I'd like to know or hear from you is there any missing point to evaluate or to deploy any CAS node, especially to overseas? And if you have experiences, please let me know a remarkable things, incident that you had. And I'd like to know how can TLDs or ASTA, Internet registries cooperate on these topics? So there are several answers, I think. No need, because of you should buy existing service is one possible answer. But this is a very important, if you think this is important, then information sharing between us, especially operational experiences, is very good things to cooperate. And if this kind of information sharing is ordinal in this area, or in, for example, in the APNIC meeting, or in some sort of internet meetings, then should we have more concrete information about it? That is my question to you. Thank you. So is there any questions? Or if you have comments, please give me.
Make a few comments. I think this document rings very true. As you know, APNIC has been involved in around 30, I believe, deployments in our region, mm-hmm. and many of the observations you make about the downside risks of deployment, the planning costs, the real-world costs, ring very true. It is extremely difficult when things go wrong, and like airline disasters, multiple things usually go wrong, and you confront language difficulties, staff change, spare parts availability. It is extremely hard. Something that I don't think your document covers, I did actually see a presentation of this document at IETF. I notice it's still an individual draft, and I think it should be adopted by a working group like DNSSOP. I would encourage you to pursue adoption. Something I haven't seen mentioned is that, and this was something we had very early on in a deployment, MPLS has a very flattening effect on apparent BGP cost, but RTT reflects real-world distance. So if by accident you attach to an MPLS cloud, which will make routers a very, very long way away, look in BGP terms local, you can have very bad asymmetry between RTT and the BGP-mediated Anycast node selection. And you will see degradation of service for some number of people. We had some limited experience with leakage into an MPLS cloud, and it appeared to create a very large transnational bridge and stole traffic aggressively until DNSRTT selection swung away. So I think it may be useful to add observations about the flattening effect of layer 2 and virtual network technology. But the document, I believe, is a very good summary of issues and considerations.
Thank you.
Are there other comments?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would now like to ask Hasaka-san to present on the reverse DNS lookup failure and its influence to the Japanese community.
Thank you, George. My name is Toshi Hosaka from JPNIC. By this presentation, I will briefly report our experience of the reverse DNS lookup failure and its impact to JP community. So we have a trouble on 2005, October 23rd, from 3:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. The trouble details are like this. Reverse DNS lookup failure to part of JP and KL networks plus ERX ranges from the APNIC region maintained in Erin reverse DNS zones. So under JPNIC management, we had 216 class Bs, and we are not sure about the KRNIC zone and APNIC ERX range. So actually, we do not know whole range, whole affected zone. But anyway, under JPNIC management, we had 216 class Bs affected. And the cause of failure is announced in the APNIC mailing list and also APNIC website. The security update on Saturday, which is October 22nd, by APNIC, caused some errors in APNIC shared zone reverse delegation data, and this resulted in some reverse DNS records accidentally being undelegated. So, what's the impact of the reverse DNS lookup failure? First, we had a denial of connection. There was a report from one of our members that network access control specified by domain rejected valid connections. And we also had a report that some emails message could not be relayed because some mail servers are doing reverse DNS lookup to prevent spam or something. In general, impact varies depending on the application setting by each server management, but reverse DNS lookup is still critical, just like forward DNS lookup for ISPs, because it could cause their service interruption. JPNIC had some complaint from our members that initial trouble report was too late. Actually, this trouble occurred on October 23rd and fixed on the same day, but JPNIC first report on this incident was made the next day, 24th, and APNIC's first report was made on 28th, 5 days later. One of our members said ISPs need immediate report as soon as the trouble happened, because they need to point out that announcement or report to report their customers as an official information. And some others said that when DNS or RIR or NIR infrastructure fails, web or email announcement cannot be worked, so telephone or fax contact is more appropriate. Or some said JPNIC has to have a 24/7 emergency contact to our members. So the issues. We should recognize again that we are responsible. We mean RIR and NIR are responsible for reverse DNS zone management, and that is important service to the community. And of course, we should consider how to prevent this kind of trouble. And we should consider how to detect the problem, how to notify the problem to the communities, how soon we can make it. And we should consider RIR, NIR cooperation, including escalation procedure, etc. Improvements for these issues are already made. For example, automated alert script implemented both APNIC and JPNIC already. And JPNIC talked with the APNIC staff, and so escalation procedure between APNIC and JPNIC was defined already. And according to APNIC, they increased the visibility of service status, and they changed the scheduled maintenance window to weekdays, avoiding weekend, because in the weekend we tend to have some trouble in communicating each other. So that's all from me. I believe following Terry's presentation follows my presentation, explaining their improvement activities.
Okay, I really do have to thank Toshi for a well-balanced presentation. We can see from APNIC that there was a substantial amount of pressure generated from this incident in the JPNIC and the JP community, and we can really only offer our apologies and a commitment to move forward from this. So I should really point out, and you can see the overview up there, but I should point out that while we're in the DNS SIG, we're really tempted to think of this issue as a failing of DNS. To be clear, DNS, in which I mean the servers and the service, has been running without fault for many years. There was no failure of protocol. The answers came back as expected. The issue was a break in process, a break in a data generation process. And in a perfect, simple world, it wouldn't have happened. But unfortunately, we know this is not a perfect, simple world. What you can see there is our current system. We have our registry. Oh, this has gone funny again. Let's pick a nice pointer. Okay, you can see the registry DB there. We have some allocation data into a registry generation process. We have the DNS generation process, a database, a DNS database, publishing zone files out to an APNIC master DNS server. And we also have APNIC WHOIS, the RIR and NIR shared zone set, as well as lameness checks. It's not particularly simple. When we think about it, we've got six different generic data sources that need to be factored in, and of these six data sources, one can be further broken down into five RIRs, three NIRs, and various other little pieces. All of these areas are really participating in the shared zone management process. So some of the more astute of you might already start to see some of the problems that are sitting there. So what actually happened? Well, this thing keeps changing. Maybe it's just me. Okay. We applied a vendor-provided security patch to maintain the security and integrity of our servers. Unfortunately, that broke registry generation. So when we actually push out zone data, or when we receive zone data from the shared or ERX space, as well as the shared zone structures from the NIRs, we actually have to verify that they are actually able to give us that data. They're authorized to do something with that data, and we can therefore push it out. So we have to verify that somewhere. So we generally verify it from the registry database. Unfortunately, because we broke it, or it broke, should I say, we were unable to verify it. So the shared zone information failed to publish. That also meant that the shared data failed to go to Aaron. So I should point out that no ordinary members were affected by this, okay? So when that shared data came out, it was essentially as if the data was being withdrawn. We were basically withdrawing or undelegating records. So DNS servers were still working, they were still fine, they were happy, they were answering, but they were answering saying, nope, I have no NSRR set for you. Before I go on to the next slide, and I really do want to point out that APNIC has been thinking about the DNS system for a long time, both before, in fact, well before this issue occurred, and even more so after this issue occurred. And we've isolated a few more potential future problems that might crop up. I wonder if you can spot them. Okay. I don't think I need to talk to this slide. Most of you can see the intention there. I think the important thing is, so what are we really going to do about this? We have come up with a new system. Now, the first thing to note is that we're actually going to change the way that the NIRs and possibly in the future members interact with us. You can see here that we're taking a look and we've in fact already implemented a prototype for XML web services. So we have the NIR, possibly the RIR, and members doing zone delegation updates over that. So what are the benefits there immediately? Well, we have immediate response for success or failure. Secured encrypted transaction. Well, we'll over web, HTTPS, excellent medium. Edge-based permissions model. That means we find out if they can or can't do it right there. No waiting 10 minutes, half an hour, straight away know if it's not going to happen. We're merging data into consistent structures. Okay? Data change will only actually happen when it's instigated by the member or the NIR. So the data just sits there in the database. It doesn't change. It only changes when an update occurs. Well, except lameness policy, okay. But that's more of a flagging to say that this is a valid zone or not. We have a much simplified generation process because of that. You saw in a couple of slides ago that we had issues about race conditions, we had consistency statements from different sources. Very simple. One DNS database, one generation process, one publish space. Very simple. Also, whois becomes a read-only view for DNS. So, benefits to the community. Well, stable generation of DNS, and that's what we're all about. We really need to make sure that happens. It's been pointed out that reverse DNS, whilst not as far as I can recall in any RFC space that says it must be there, is fast becoming an operational critical service. That basically means people are relying on it because it's there. And because that reliance is there, it then becomes a critical service. So we're always going to use the last known good data, always. Secure and consistent update mechanism. Certificate-based access controls. Okay, we tend to be fairly blasé about security, unfortunately, despite the fact that we're in the IT world and we have that many IT security conferences occurring. People still use Telnet for managing routers and they still like to send passwords via email. So, certificate-based access controls, we know who you are. Encrypted transaction, you can be sure that the discussion between you and us is encrypted. And it's not going to be replayed, it's not going to be intercepted, unless it's the CIA, maybe. Sorry, I won't offend too many US people here. It's scalable and extensible. Well, it's XML, so we've written the schema for this. We can do one zone in one atomic update, or we can do thousands of zones. It's just a nice stream of XML. And we have future support for DNS developments, like, oh, maybe DNSSEC, perhaps, if it is accepted in the Asia-Pacific community. Transition. Well, the focus here at the moment is on the NIR. None of the ordinary members' data was affected, so right now we're really going to concentrate on the NIR space to make sure we can give those guys the service that they do deserve and their community deserves. So we're obviously going to gather some NIR feedback, and in fact, a couple of days ago we had a meeting with the NIRs, and we've already showed them a glimpse of this. So we're going to gather their feedback from this and progress this to production. Obviously, you know, that's not just as easy as snapping my fingers and it's done. I wish it were. We're going to convert to the NIR to using XML over web. And where necessary, I actually think the NIRs are pretty smart people. They have quite a good history and a very able technical body. We'll assist where it's necessary. And in future, member. Well, we need to adjust the tools for member use. Because this is at the moment focused for the NIR, it's not particularly a nice front end, so to speak. We'll always have to communicate a cutover date as per normal APNIC process of the way we do things. We'll make some tools available to the member. And we can migrate the email update members to those tools using either my APNIC or an XML client that allows them to push their updates. And who is becomes read-only for DNS. So I've actually just very briefly rushed through this because I don't want to chew up Ed's time because I know he's dying to come up here and tell us about EPP. But while I'm here, let me just spin over to another screen. Sorry. What does a prototype look like? Okay, you can see we've got a development server currently running. It's using the REST model. If you're aware of REST, it's representational state transfer, I believe. Basically takes the URL, in this case RDNS IPv4 202.12.29, which happens to be the APNIC network, and converts that into a GET, basically. The scripts sitting behind that give us back this wonderful piece of information. As you can see, it's HTTPS using my certificate, so it knows who I am. The transaction between my laptop and that server, encrypted. The interesting thing here is that if we do a show source, oh look, we have some XML. We actually mark it up a little bit with a style sheet, so that's what gives you the nice stuff, the little crosses and things like that. But right there, we have the XML. We can see that the zone name is there, the space is there, the authority is there, APNIC. It's currently using version 1. We have a modified date and name servers, all in a nicely constructed set. Now, if I were to maybe remove that one and put in that one, and then if I were to publish changes, that would go straight into our database. Unfortunately, it won't because my certificate knows who I am and doesn't think I'm authorized to do that. So, that's as simple as it is, and I think as simple as it could possibly get. Let me go back to my main slides. Sorry for the spinning. These Macs are wonderful things. Okay. So, what sort of schedule do we have? Well, unfortunately, it's pending work assessment. Why is it pending work assessment? Well, it takes a fair bit of work to transition from what we have now to what we're going to have. It's not a two-day process by any means, and we are really going to be focusing on the NIRs. So, we expect to be able to make an announcement by APNIC 22 on the future of this, how long it's going to take and when it can be given to the membership. We expect the NIRs to have it well before that, obviously pending their cooperation. So, are there any questions?
Excuse me. This is not question, but request.
Yes.
The reverse, IP address reverse lookup sometimes very slow because of the name server lookup go to the forward lookup and then go back to reverse lookup. And this kind of lookup continues very several times. So that putting NIM server in the reverse zone itself will reduce the lookup times in the DNS. So that I think in your registration page, registration system, the name server for the inside zone name and the GRU A record can be registered.
We've actually considered putting the GLU record there. However, I think there's a bigger discussion at a wider community about the issues about putting GLU records into the ARPA tree.
Yes, there is a DNS draft in Bailiwick name service required, and it has been subject to different points of view. Not everyone feels as confident that this is necessarily a good thing, but if the wider community did reach a point where it was considered best standard practice, we would obviously reconsider what we were going to do. But at this stage, we don't yet have GLU support in our registry systems, and we're kind of holding back from that.
Mike Granoy Garnett. We use the PGP email to do Whois updates for contact info. Is that going to be dropped completely?
We're talking about DNS here, so if you're doing updates to DNS, that will probably...
We probably wouldn't, because they're not a registry per se, but...
Right. I probably can't speak for the future of the interactions for DNS updates, or in fact, Whois updates, what we call Whois updates at this point in time. But I would expect some changes.
Right.
Sorry, I can't be any more precise than that.
That's fine.
Yeah.
This may be a detail, but when you send XML with XSS style sheet to a browser, you obtain very different results among the browser. Did you experience problem?
Especially
with a very common browser?
That doesn't work under Safari. It works under Mozilla fairly well, and it works under Microsoft okay. We're aware of the XSLT style sheet issues, but keeping in mind that right now this is a prototype in demo space, and what we're really looking at is the underlying functionality here that is getting information in a sensible fashion from the NIRs and from the members.
We had almost exactly that experience of the apparent effect of showing a browser-based tool when we demonstrated this in-house. People immediately thought about browser interactions and were saying, could you make the crosses bigger and could you move the fields up? And we were saying, no, that's a demonstrator of AJAX. That's showing about client-side AJAX embedded behavior. What we're trying to show is the source, the show source and the XML tagging. That's the real part that matters to us. And we've developed a Perl application that was 40 lines long of Perl with a include statement to get an XML parsing library, and it fetches a URL, dumps it as plain text, you make a one-line change, you feed it as input, and it does the update. And we actually don't think that the style sheet-based tool will be in any sense what we expose. If we ran a web interface into our system, we would probably be mediating that in another form of web design and then using XML at the back end to talk to something as middleware. We have some architectural reasons for doing that. But yes, the problem of the style sheets and browser conformance and behavior, we were very aware that there are problems there. We still think that it's good technology, and we're very interested in using that as a way of enhancing our services. And an observation here is that the relativities of browser use in the community that we are in is very different to general public use. It tends to be more about Safari than IE, for instance, the question that arose, what works and what doesn't work. So it is an important issue, but the primary message is XML tagging and SSL secured identities to give authority to make update. Well spotted that problem.
Uh,
Another web service question. Did you consider, beside your this interface, did you consider SOAP or XML RPC? Or yes, no, maybe, yes. Why?
We considered a few things, but it came down to the way our basic framework at this point in time works. So we're actually considering the future, and we're actually considering the MyAPNIC project and the way it behaves. And the REST model actually fit better in longer-term space for the merging of the technology.
In particular, SOAP, BEEP have an extremely high transaction cost. It's not atomic operations, datagram-like behavior. You establish a heavyweight connection which has quite high overhead, and you do something and then you tear it down again, and it just did not feel comfortable to us. It's not to say there is no value in that in the sense of a session layer, but it REST, the compelling simplicity of four primitive operations focusing on a namespace and use of HTML, HTTP as a ubiquitous transport worked better for us. That was really an initiative more in the software group, I would say, that they have been fighting for a very long time about what is an appropriate transport, and they just couldn't make SOAP or BEEP or BXXP work comfortably for them. It just didn't fit. Do you think this is running counter to the rest of the world, or do you feel this is a general trend?
Because we use SOAP in production, and the main problem, as I see it, is a problem of interoperability. It's as soon as you start, when you just send the character strings and use very basic operation, it works. But when you start to do funny things with SOAP or sending exotic data types, exotic being simply a date, a time, things like that, you have a lot of problems because you have a registrar we use a SOAP library for PHP. It works with one version, not with the other, etc. So for me, the big problem with SOAP is this one. You have a lot of support problem with registrar.
Yeah, that was another thing we considered. We do have, obviously, in the Asia-Pacific community, multiple languages, and there is still is the push for internationalized domain structures. So we really do need to be able to support multiple character sets, multiple everything, and we can encapsulate that extremely well with the REST model using XML. Any further questions? Okay. I might as well just introduce Ed.
We will be talking about DNS APNIC, how EPP may play a role. Serious save the world.
So did you say you were here to save the world?
Stefan, the question you asked last, I almost asked the same thing. Because in some places we provision different things, not just internet. And another registry that we do, we would rather use XML or SOAP. But that has to do with the environment it's in is a SOAP environment. And that, so I was concerned looking at this too. I think that might be too heavyweight for the kind of interaction that's being described here. So I think it's more a matter of what you're building into, what you would layer it in. So I think it's a reasonable question too. Of course, I'm talking about EPP here. I'm going to. The agenda I have is I'm going to talk a little bit about reverse map interfaces, and then a little bit about EPP and the number of registries, where EPP came from, DNSSEC and the number of registries, and then EPP's extension for DNSSEC, which came out, which is, I think it's a published RFC now. I know that I had the number, but I don't know if it was published yet. I'm talking a little bit about why passing DNSSEC data is kind of a special case, and then I have a quick demo that I will show to show some of the fact that we've actually done this kind of code already. From what I understand, this is how the world, or how data make it past. Let's see which end do I look into? through APNIC. If I'm a holder of IP space and I have a DNS operation somewhere, I need to, for DNSSEC, and I'm not going to explain exactly what's flowing yet, but the data from DNSSEC has to flow back up the tree, ultimately to be in the into the zone somewhere else. Some people may go straight to an LIR or to a sub-LIR. Some may talk to the NAR. I guess I don't have a line from the NAR up there. But eventually, APNIC may have to get information about the delegation. So one thing to consider here is that with DNSSEC, we have all these new lines of communication are coming up, and we're going to have to send data back and forth that's not exactly simple to send back and forth. First thing, the EPP and the number registries. EPP is defined in the IETF. It's, quite frankly, was designed for the ICANN shared registry model. It's mostly for domain names. If you look at the way it's defined now, it doesn't even pretend to be there for the number registries. EPP is a basic client-server protocol for putting in requests, getting back responses. Now, when it comes to the RIRs case, it's not hard to imagine how this might be used in the RIRs. However, I wouldn't go out and say that RIRs should adopt EPP because what's in there today is not much, it's not bad, and this would change the world greatly. It would make things a little more smoothly with the domain names, but for the most part, I don't know that there's no real compelling reason to uplift the front end of a registry, RIRs for this. However, with DNSSEC coming out, there might be a case here where this putting DNSSEC data into the DNS, into the registries, might benefit from using EPP. Now, there are other alternatives. I'm just bringing this up as a suggested course to look at. DNSSEC, it's defined again in these RFCs. The big thing here is that the parent of a delegation, we have parent and child terminology, the parent's going to have to hold a DS record. A DS record is going to be about, I think, 20 or so hex characters long, or basically 20-something kind of characters long. It's a hash of the keys that are going to be at the child's zone. So it's not a record. It's a record that's pretty easy to read, but it makes no sense. It's a little hard to type it in. RIPNCC has signed their zones, and you notice that there are already queries coming in for some of the DNSSEC records. RIPE's interface right now is through a DSR data attribute. So when they do their template processing, you just put it at a DSR data, and you get your DS record in there. EPP and DNSSEC, now we have EPP for the domain name registries. We have the DNSSEC going on in two different worlds. Quite a while it was realized that we want to have the domain name registries get DNSSEC in, so they put an extension to EPP. So we have this RFC that's out of 4310. It can take either the DS record or the DNS key record. Some people want choices about what they pass back and forth. And one other parameter in there, which I'll leave, the maximum signature time. It's hard to explain what that really means. And this is basically another extension to the EPP protocol. Now, what's most notable about DNSSEC data passing is that it's more frequent. Typically, if you get an address space from APNIC, you set up name servers, and you may never, ever change those name servers. If you never change the name servers, you never have to update the DNS data at all. You may never go back and change your name server records, your Whois records. We never have to change for that. With DNSSEC, it has to be updated every so often because the DS records will actually kind of go bad over time. There's also increased bulk. The DS record is much less mnemonic. It's just a string of bits and characters that represent something that's somewhat random. So you're not talking about something that's easy to remember and type it in. It's not a catchphrase. It's just some characters. And actually, they're assigned to you by the software tools. You don't generate them yourself. So I have a quick demo that shows this actually works. What I'm going to show you is internal code we used to help develop the RFC. So this code, this is not the end user production, but this is just to show you that this is actually a realistic scenario. And before I go into the demo, I'm going to have a bunch of windows up here. What I'm kind of highlighting here is the interaction between those two windows up there. The EPP is the protocol running between the two machines. Actually, it's all on one machine, two windows, rather. I'm going to have in the lower left side of this what a user of the internet would look, not a user, I guess the registrant would have. They're going to be working on their DNSSEC data. They're going to have files there. They're going to get the DNSSEC data from. They want to get that data into the DNS, so they would go up to the EPP client. Now, this would involve actually going through some intermediaries and some client software. The client would get that and then transfer the request over to the server, which will then, in our implementation today for demo purposes, uses a log file. I dump a file out. It said, here's a request an EPP has just gotten. I have another update client, which is doing NS update, will read that file and see that there's an update and then update a running DNS server on my machine. So this has actually worked every time I've tried it, so I'm tempting fate here. Again, this window here is the person doing the work and trying to update the DNS. This window up here is the client that will pass this data across. And this, you imagine, this is kind of the major interface going back and forth. This would be what's sitting at the server side, like, for example, an APNIC in this case. We accept the requests. You'll see this thing register that there's some data to be put in there. And down here, this is a live running name server. And to kind of prove it, I'm going to do a dig. Child.tld. And I think if I ask for the SOA record, I'll get an error right now because I haven't registered the name. I'm going to cheat a bit to save some time. And these are the commands to set up the domain. And also I have to log in. This is the magic of demo. It looks like I'm actually putting a user ID and password into it. The truth is it doesn't matter what I type there. But the connection will start up. And now I'm going to paste in the three lines that will create the domain. I hope. There they go. Whew. Three for three so far. So now if I ask the same query, I now get an answer because I actually have that domain delegated. This is the uninteresting part of it. That's just setting up the domain name, and we're in registry space, so we don't want to listen to that. But the next thing in here is I've got this file, which is, this is the DS record, and this is the thing I have to convey from one side to the other. That's why I mean it's kind of bulky, it's kind of ugly. That's got to go back and forth. So what I need to do is just go back, I'm going to go back to my commands here to cheat again. And I need to ask to update child.tld and add the DS record. And there's a parameter to the side here. This is reading exactly what's in a file, the four parameters of a DS record plus a number which says, and don't sign this signature for more than 9,000 seconds in case there's some kind of a key is corrupted or something. I don't want to have too much damage at the time. So I use that. And that has now updated the zone through dynamic update. And now in this case, this looks the same, but I can also ask it for DNSSEC proof. And let's see. And the records are here. I'm getting the referral here. It's saying go to the child.tld, and here's the DS record saying that's where it is now. This is not, recursion is not turned on. So basically that just puts in the DS record, which is what I'm after in this. So the kind of suggestion I'm putting out here is that this EPP is a way of transporting this data across the interface. It could deal with some of the other different paths of how data has to get up there. Again, it's a suggestion right now. I don't know if it's going to fit into with the tools that Terry was showing too. That's another interface. It may be that gets worked in too, that you want the DS record to come in through there. So, anyway. So any questions?
So I'm not so catch up the EPP for DNSSEC EPP draft. So that this is question in the Scott's draft, the DNSSEC key is itself not a DS key, but your system is using DS key for the EPP.
Actually, Scott, well, Scott's this is actually based on Scott's draft. Scott's draft became the RFC 4310, and Scott and I worked on this last year, and he's seen this demo. We went through this. The way that his document treats the data transfer, you can send in the DS record, and as an optional attribute, you can send in the DNS key. Initially, when there was discussion about this in the IETF working group, a couple of people there said they prefer to send the DNS key back and forth as opposed to the DS key. But that was one set of opinion. A growing opinion was that the job of a registry is to publish a DS record. It's not the job of the registry to produce the DS record. So the whole idea was that the registrant produces the DS record, hands it over to the registry, and the registry just puts it out there. I mean, registries don't do any other processing of data that comes in here. I mean, of course, you know, in APNIC, you're getting address space. That takes some thought and some thinking about how much space do you deserve based on your application. But after that, everything that you tell them you want to have published, it's a straight, you know, they're just registering this belongs with that resource. So we were discussing in the mailing group, and more people in the working group, rather, really felt that the DS really is the unit of data that should go back and forth. We left the DNS key in there. And I asked people who wanted that there, show me a case where that was a better, you know, approach than DS. And for the most part, the people that the challenge is kind of still out there. Most people that prefer the DNS key eventually change their mind without much, you know, hitting them over the head. But the DS key actually won out in almost all of the discussions about that. So, sure.
Is your source code available?
No, actually, this code is internal code, and we haven't really thought about distributing it. It's more to demonstrate the concept of the protocol being plugged into places than a real tool for. Obviously, this tool is not very usable.
No, but the proof of concept code is interesting.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if we actually do come up with what we consider to be proof of concept code.
I'm going to do what every good chair never does and leave this room to your good selves, because I actually have a double schedule and have to go next door to run a PGP keying activity. Ah. So please do carry on in my absence.
No,
it's at 5:30. Yes, it's at 5:30 according to my schedule. Do you know what? I'm going to ignore the piece of paper and stay in this room till 6 o'clock.
Do what they did yesterday and get that microphone tuned into next door speakers. Terry, how do you do that again? Yeah. Good time. I think we'd have to go back and decide if we want to distribute the code. This code was actually done just internally, and it was done primarily just before the RFC development. So people have been asking me for the code. So far, I know this is maybe the only copy of it's on this disk, and maybe a backup server at home. So,
to be slightly more on topic,
we do know that other people in our space have looked at extending EPP into namespace management. I mean, that is already going on. So your code might not be available, but we certainly do know this is a viable activity.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take this side comment we had about the viability of SOAP and BEEP as meaning this can't fly, but it is noticeable there was a lot of chatter on the wire there.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the bottom three windows were demonstrating DNS dynamic update.
Right.
And we have had discussions in APNIC about looking to improve on service. Now, it is way too early to make any public commitment, but we are considering
right.
the implications of offering live update. And the signal we're getting is that a part of the value add that would be a trade-off for the changes in resource management would be looking into providing full lifecycle update. If you make a change, we will commit to publishing as far as possible immediately, but it's too soon to say what shape that would take.
Yeah, dynamic update, there was a question about that in the workshop that was last week, and I actually surprised Bill Manning. He's saying, well, when will the TLDs adopt a dynamic update? I said, well, we had to a long time ago because of the size of the zones that we were running. You can't, you know, you don't want to reload the whole zone every time you make a change. So dynamic update is actually a key element of most large zones that are being published out there already. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to see the update immediately. In the rules that we run by, we have to have a name out there. And I offhand, I don't know what it is, but it's, you know, less than an hour, easily less than an hour. So to meet that, you had to go to dynamic update for at least the master, and then an incremental transfer for zone slave, master to slave.
We have the added complexity that with the shared zone issues in the RIR space with ERX historical records, we would not be in a position to do dynamic updates in all zones that we have. So the commitment has to be mediated. Now, clearly, we'd like to discuss with the other registries ways to improve update cycle, but there will be spaces we manage where the update cycle might be 4 hours or it might be half a day. Now, the part Terry demonstrated that the update in our database, in registry, gives you immediate feedback, that's a locked-in commitment. We want to have turnaround that you know immediately our systems have an update of what you have. Yeah. But in real DNS space, propagation into the global DNS is actually not something even dynamic DNS update can control. And some of the diagnostic that we've been doing in the community has actually exposed that issue, that we make changes in DNS, and the test paths using DNS servers can be very, very strange. The caching properties of the deployed DNS can make proving something has been done really quite tricky.
Yeah.
So it's not quite live. There was one other comment I wanted to make to expand a bit on something Terry said. You were saying that you're doing PGP-based update at the moment, and... Yeah, well, at the point where APNIC felt it was able to ask for withdrawal of a mail-based update cycle, there would have to be, first of all, a public discussion and commitment from the membership that they're prepared for that, and secondly, some kind of an overlap. So you're certainly not going to have us turn up at the next meeting and say it's turned off tomorrow, but if you're in a position to think about your own in-house management processes, The stuff we're talking about here, XML parsing, using Perl methodologies, they're good things to be looking at now because it could put you in an extremely good place for ultimately replacing those processes. Yeah. But it's not on the horizon, but it's certainly over the horizon.
Yeah, George, I want to make a comment too about if you're thinking about going to a more dynamic update of DNS that's seen by the outside world, you also have to tie in dynamic. You want to dynamically update the whois also. So this is a registry architecture question, that if you want to make the registry, you know, how fast do you want the registry to flicker for one update to the directory, the database?
George has gone and opened up a kettle of fish. Yes. Something like that. I'll just mix my metaphors. It's all right. The dynamic update creates some interesting aspects. Firstly, at this point in time, whenever anyone submits a whois object for a domain object via AutoDBM, it's actually checked for sanity first. That means we actually check the name servers first. Now, checking name servers actually takes time. So if we go to a front-to-back dynamic system that a member can submit an object via an XML REST model, it's highly unlikely that we're actually going to check name servers, check that the zone is authoritative or the name servers are authoritative for the zone, and then give them a response. Why? Because we've got timeouts, we've got retransmissions, we've got all those sort of issues. So I would probably suspect that we're going to blindly accept what they give us and then punch that into the zone. However, that kind of disagrees with our current mode of operation. So there's a lot more discussion that needs to happen here, and that also does, as you've pointed out, suggest that whois should also be dynamic.
Yeah, we've noticed that from our experience that, yeah.
That's not particularly the case in many situations. The RIPE software has NRTM near real-time, but right. That's not quite perfectly dynamic, and that can be, in fact, lag. So there are issues abound.
To give you an idea of why I bring that up is there have been some cases where someone in the domain name space, I can go in there and register a domain name, get myself approved to send mail, send a whole lot of spam, and then withdraw my delegation. There's two ways to do this, too. Withdraw the delegation before the Whois was ever updated with my identity, so no one can ever look me up. That's one. That was one notice. The other thing that happens is let's see, what was the other one? I just forgot the other. The other one too is in the domain name. This is unique to domain names too, where you pay for a name. There's also a period of time where you can say, "Oh, forget it. I didn't want to pay for that name. Buy a name, send the spam. Oh, you know, undo the name." So this is partly because Whois is also not a historical record. It's what's out there currently too. So I would say before you know, dynamic update of DNS is pretty nice feature to have, especially when you get to DNSSEC and you're getting to more realistic more you know, data actually meaning more data than, you know, especially in this case here where the DNS records would change, you want to keep things updated. But you've got to be careful not to lunge too forward with dynamic DNS without dynamically updating whatever else is out there to hold people accountable for what's in the DNS.
Yeah, I agree.
So by showing the dynamic update here, I'm not trying to say, look, it's a great thing. Dynamic update comes because of EPP.
Yeah.
It just works this way in our demo world. So. Any other? Okay.
Well, that's it. Sorry, the microphone Nancy is telling me I need to go here.
We have come to the end of our agenda, so thank you very much for coming to the DNS SIG, and we will present a summary of the discussions here in the APNIC meeting on Friday. Thank you.